batter through plenty of doors in the simulation. Passing the seventh floor, he could hear Joe and Nagano banging against something up above. "How are we doing?" he shouted. "First miscalculation," Joe shouted. "Roof door is padlocked. We're trying to break it down. But hey, there was bound to be at least one problem with the plan."
"One problem would be fine," Kurt shouted. "But we have two. The lead warbot isn't waiting for backup."
"So slow it down," Joe shouted. Easier said than done, Kurt thought. He considered the sword in his hand.
Too bad Masamune didn't make rocket launchers.
"Should we look for another way up?"
Joe asked. Looking around, Kurt spotted something that might be of use.
"No," he shouted. "Keep working on the door."
"What are you going to do?"
"My best exterminator routine."
While Joe and Nagano continued to batter the door two flights above him, Kurt swung the Masamune at the dilapidated railing along the edge of the stairwell. After hacking through the rusted metal at the bottom, he wrenched the obstruction out of his way. That done, he rushed to a pile of rubble where part of the wall had collapsed. He found a sizable wedge of concrete lying on the floor. It was too heavy to lift, but getting low and pushing with both legs, he was able to slide it across the floor. He pushed it to the edge of the stairwell and waited. The robot was two flights down now, moving and scanning and moving again. It had an almost alien style of locomotion. It paused on each landing, scanning the area for any heat signatures. Just a little farther. Finally, it made the turn, appearing out in the open 10 feet below Kurt. With a mighty shove, Kurt pushed the 200-pound chunk of cement over the edge. It dropped straight down, hitting the robot just off center, crushing several of its appendages and literally flattening it. Its six legs splayed out in all directions, and for a second Kurt thought he'd destroyed it. But the robot began to move, and the slab of concrete slid off of it and onto the floor. Freed of the weight, the machine sprang back up to its feet. And I thought roaches were hard to kill. Back in action, the machine tilted upward, locked onto Kurt with the targeting laser, and opened fire. Kurt dove out of the way, but he needn't have bothered. Down below, an explosion rocked the stairwell. Kurt risked a glance. The barrel of the weapon was sheared off, and what remained was splayed out. It had blown itself apart when the warbot opened fire. "The concrete slab must have bent the barrel," Kurt said, "just as I planned." The robot was not destroyed, but at least it was neutered. Kurt took off, charging back up the stairs. "Back in the lead," he shouted. "Humans two, robots one." He reached the top floor and found the door open where Joe and Nagano had finished breaking it down. Stepping through and wedging it shut again, he stepped out into the rain. Joe and Nagano were standing at the edge of the roof, staring at a gap between the building and its neighbor. Joe gave him the bad news.
"Hate to tell you, amigo, but the bridge is out."
"The brace should be here," Kurt said. Joe pointed to the corroded remnants of a mounting that jutted out from the edge of the building a grand total of 8 inches.
"I think it used to be here."
Kurt shook his head ruefully.
"Old photos," he muttered. "Never rely on old photos."
Glancing over the edge, Kurt could see a dozen of the warbots heading their way. Others had undoubtedly already entered the building. "Unfortunately, the rest of our plan is working to perfection. The warbots are coming in droves."
"Now what?" Nagano asked.
Kurt studied the building across from them. The gap was only 6 feet, and the roof of the other building was a half-story lower than the one they were standing on. He pointed across the gap with the sword. "We've only got one choice." The three of them exchanged glances, backed up a few feet, and then ran for the edge. They jumped at the last instant, propelling themselves up and across the gap, before dropping down through the darkness. "Warbot number 8 is out of action and offline," the controller said. Gao was staring at a blank screen.
"What happened?"
"Isn't it obvious?" Oni said. "The rifle exploded. The barrel must have been damaged by the impact of the concrete block.
A man would have known that and avoided firing. So much for your perfect robots.
The others will finish them, Gao said confidently. There's no way off that roof.
Gao switched the video feed to a different machine, and they all watched as it passed the damaged warbot and climbed the stairs all the way to the roof. It burst out through the door and scanned every quadrant. After a brief delay, the controller spoke.
No targets in sight.
What about the other floors? Gao asked. They may have doubled back. The controller flicked through the data screens. We have machines on every level of the building now. No thermal signature on any floor. No sign of movement. We've lost them.
Gao pushed the controller out of the way and looked at the telemetry data himself.
This is impossible. They have to be in the building somewhere.
That Oni was looking over his shoulder, breathing down his neck, made it all the worse.
Show me a map of the island, the assassin requested.
Why?
Indulge me.
Gao fumed, but did as requested. The screen flicked, and a wire outline of the island and all its buildings appeared.
Red dots show the positions of the warbots, Gao explained. Most of them clustered in the building the Americans and Nagano had been in moments ago.
It took only a second for Oni to see what he needed.
Do you have something to stop those machines from killing me by mistake if I go out there?
An identifier, Gao said, pointing to a rack of devices hanging on lanyards by the console.
As long as you're wearing one of those, the machines will recognize you as a friend, and they won't target you.
Oni looked pleased. He pointed toward Gao with the sword.
Give me one, he demanded, and put one on yourself.
Me? Why?
Because I know where the Americans are going, he said, and you're coming with me.
Chapter 54 Nagano was limping.
That jump hurt you, Joe said, taking as much of Nagano's weight on himself as he could.
Nagano winced, and then forced a smile. Actually, the jump was fine, but the landing was quite painful.
A couple of sake bombers back on the mainland and you'll be good as new, Joe said.
Nagano laughed, but he needed a rest. Kurt went ahead to scout out the building, so they sat down and waited for him to return. After a few minutes, Kurt appeared. No sign of our robot friends.
Thankfully, they don't have wings, Joe said.
Kurt nodded and broke out the Pneuma transceiver.
Time to call for help, he said, turning it on and waiting for it to sync up. When a green light told him it was ready, he pressed the transmit button.
Akiko, are you out there?
Several seconds went by without a response.
Let's hope she hasn't tossed the transceiver overboard because it's a piece of modern technology, Joe said.
Akiko, this is Kurt. Do you read me? Press the transmit button on the side of the receiver if you do.
Static, and then, I know how to use a radio, thank you.
Glad you're still with us, Kurt said. Have you had any problems?
Aside from bailing rainwater all night, no.
Wish we could say the same, Kurt replied.
Good news is we've got Nagano. Bad news, we're being hounded. We're going to meet you halfway. Can you get the boat in position?
Yes, she said. Absolutely.
Watch for us, Kurt said. We're going to use the wing and the parasail.
I'll collect you as soon as you hit the water.
Kurt acknowledged the transmission and put the transceiver away.
The diagonal bridge is three levels below us. Let's go.
They made their way down the stairs and found the diagonal bridge that they'd crossed on the way in. After scouting for robots, they stole across the bridge and entered the building they'd landed on. They soon located the main stairwell and began climbing until they reached the top floor and the fallen concrete slab they'd used as a ramp on the way in.
Scaling it was slow and difficult. It was slick with rainwater, grime, and mold.
Kurt moved upward on his hands and knees. The Honjo Masamune still clutched in one hand, which slowed him down enough that Joe was the first to reach the summit. As Joe's head rose above ground level, someone started firing at him. Bullets hit around him, kicking up water spouts and blasting chips of concrete from the rooftop.
Joe dropped back and slid down the wet slab, collecting Nagano and Kurt on the way.
Wasn't expecting a welcoming party, Kurt said. Let's see who it is, Joe replied.
He eased his way back to the top, held the 9mm pistol out over the edge, and fired several shots in the general direction of the target. Enough to get anyone to duck. With a second to take a look, Joe glanced over the edge and then dropped back down again.
Robots? Kurt asked.
Joe shook his head. Yakuza assassin with an axe to grind. Or should I say sword? He's got a pistol in one hand and that katana in the other.
Is he alone?
Han's man Gao is with him.
Throw your weapons out and surrender,
Oni's voice boomed across the rooftop.
So you can frame us for murdering the Japanese Prime Minister?
Joe shouted back.
No thanks.
Then come up and fight, Oni said, or wait for the robots to come up and tear you apart. It makes no difference to me.
He does have us at a disadvantage, Nagano said.
And he's not wrong, Kurt said. The situation is only going to get worse when the robots arrive.
So we charge him and take our chances, Joe suggested.
I thought you were against suicidal plans, Kurt said.
In principle, Joe said, but we're running out of options.
I have an idea, Kurt told him. Keep him talking. Fire a shot his way every once in a while to keep his attention on you.
As Kurt spoke, he held up the sword. I'm going to flank him, samurai style. As Kurt moved off, Joe crawled up the slab and triggered off a single round as a conversation starter.
You don't have much to hide behind up there, he pointed out. Out in the open and all exposed. All I need is one good shot and you're a dead man.
You'll never get that lucky, Oni laughed. But if you want to come up and play, I'll allow it. I'll even let you get to your feet and give you a fighting chance.
I suspect he's probably lying, Nagano said. Joe laughed.
And I suspect you're right.
In response to the offer, Joe held the gun over the opening and fired again.
As Joe distracted Ushioni, Kurt rushed to the far side of the building. A brief glimpse outside told him the army of six-legged robots were surrounding the place and crawling inside.
He saw at least a dozen. There would be no slow, methodical search this time. Just a swarming attack.
Time is not on our side, Kurt whispered. Time for desperate measures.
Climbing out through a window, Kurt made it to a ledge on the side of the building. Inching along the ledge, he came to the rusted fire escape that he and Joe had declined to use on the way down. He could hear Joe shouting at Ushioni.
If the robots fill us full of lead, that will be hard to explain to the coroner, Joe shouted.
We'll just dump your bodies in the channel and let the sharks have you, Oni replied. The police can look for you forever. It makes no difference to me.
Kurt reached out for the fire escape and grabbed the railing. The structure swayed as he hooked one leg over the railing. He waited for Joe to snap off another round. With the gunshot echoing, Kurt pulled himself onto the fire escape and did his best to steady it. The metal stairs creaked and groaned, but they didn't collapse. He went up, moving with deliberate care. One arm, one foot, the next arm, and the next foot. He carried only the sword. As he got near the top, the stairs began to pull away from the wall. The upper anchors were completely loose, just resting in small holes of eroded concrete. Only a length of wire, wound in a figure eight from the railing to the wall, kept the whole stairway from breaking away.
Definitely not up to code, he whispered, reaching past the railing and grabbing the wall.
Finding a handhold, he eased the fire escape toward the building until it made contact with the wall. Out on the roof, the taunting continued.
You might want to save that ammunition. The crawlers will be here soon.
Joe's reply was to fire off several additional shots, perfectly spaced to give Kurt the time he needed. Kurt leapt over the wall and onto the roof. He raced forward with the Honjo Masamune in his hands, closing on Oni and Gao as they took cover. Gao saw him first.
Look out!
Oni spun, raising his pistol to fire, but Kurt slashed down with the samurai's weapon and knocked the gun from Oni's hand, taking part of the assassin's thumb with it. payback in some sense, for what Oni had done to Nagano. The pistol clattered to the roof and discharged in a random direction. Oni spat contempt and spun away. Kurt had to change focus and deal with Gao, who was diving for the gun. He intercepted Gao with a kick to the jaw and then sent the pistol sliding across the roof with a flick of the sword. Now Oni came back at him, swinging the crimson blade in a wide arc. Kurt deflected it, and then dodged Oni's second attack, stepping deftly to the side. But even with blood pouring from his wounded thumb, Oni pressed forward, fueled by rage. Kurt counterattacked, slashing at Oni's head, but the assassin's training kicked in and he pulled back and responded with a riposte, one that almost twisted the sword from Kurt's hand. Kurt clutched the Honjo Masamune and wrenched it free with brute strength. But before he could do any more, he was attacked once again. "You're an amateur," Oni chided. "I'll slice you limb from limb." "You couldn't do it before, and all I had was a wrench," Kurt said. Oni charged again, slashing and taunting Kurt simultaneously. "This blade has waited 200 years to taste blood again. Tonight, it will drink deeply." Kurt was too busy defending himself to offer a witty reply. He parried to thrusts and attempted a counter by dropping one hand to the floor and lunging low and fast, a move known as a passata soto. Oni hopped back out of the way and then came forward again. The attack became manic. Sparks flew each time the swords came together. Blood from Oni's missing thumb tip soaked the hilt of his weapon and dripped along the blade. Kurt was hard-pressed, and with each flurry he was forced backward toward the edge of the roof. At the same time, he saw Gao crawling toward the fallen pistol. "Joe!" he shouted. "A little help!" Joe was already out on the roof. He charged toward Gao and tackled him. As they wrestled for the pistol, Oni attacked once again. First, it was a lunge. Kurt dodged it. Next came a feint that unbalanced Kurt. He slipped on the wet roof and he fell to one knee. Now Oni went for his head, gripping the crimson blade with both hands and bringing it downward in an executioner's chop that would slice Kurt in two. Kurt raised the Masamune and blocked the downward strike, but he was left in a defenseless position. With no chance to stand, Kurt lunged forward and drove his shoulder into Oni's thighs. He wrapped his free arm around the man's legs and with a mighty heave, lifted up and arched himself backward, releasing Oni as he fell. Oni flew helplessly over the wall, landed on the fire escape, and clung desperately to the rusted metal steps. The staircase swayed back and then jerked to a stop as the jerry-rigged wire pulled taut. Kurt stepped to the wall. Oni stared up at him, a strange expression affixed to his face. The crimson blade of Muramasa fell from Oni's hand and dropped down between the rungs. It clanked between the steps, then vanished into the dark. Ushioni clutched at his midsection. His hands came away, soaked with his own blood. The blade had gouged him when he landed on the stairway. It had cut him deep, but not fatally. Kurt didn't wait for him to recover or pull another weapon. With a downward slash of the Honjo Masamune, he cut the retaining wire in half and then shoved the reeling stairway with his foot. It peeled away from the building, bending and groaning as it collapsed into the alleyway, 10 stories below. Chapter 55. "My robots will finish you," Gao muttered. Joe held him down, but that didn't stop him from talking. "You can hear them coming. Stay here and they'll destroy you. Run, and they'll hunt you without mercy." Kurt grabbed the identifier that hung around Gao's neck and yanked it free, snapping the lanyard. "I'd be more concerned with what happens when they find you, Mr. Gao." "What is that?" Nagano asked. "A transmitter that tells the robots who to shoot and who to ignore," Kurt said. "I saw one of these in Han's factory. Turns out that visit was highly educational." Gao squirmed and strained against the hold Joe had put him in. "That'll only protect one of you." "More importantly, it won't protect you," Kurt said. He turned to Joe. "Let him up. Joe released Gao, who stood and made a desperate grab for the electronic device in Kurt's hand. Kurt pulled back out of reach and held the point of the sword forward. It kept Gao at bay. There's a stairway in the north corner of the building. If you run, you might make it. You might even bypass your own machines and get back to your underground lair. But I wouldn't wait around if I was you. Like you said, they're coming. Gao looked at Kurt with hatred, but not for very long. He took off running, heading for the north corner of the building. Nice of you to give him a sporting chance, Joe said. He has no chance, Kurt replied, and we could use a little distraction. Let's get the wing to the front edge of the building. We're going to have to drop in pretty hard to get enough speed. Working together, they shoved the wing across the rooftop and set it on the wall at the front of the building. They helped Nagano up onto the wing. He dropped to his knees and wrapped his arms through the nylon straps used to carry the wing. Kurt and Joe took their positions and raised the chute until it caught the wind and rose up behind them. The sound of gunfire rang out several floors below. One staccato burst, followed by a shout. Two more bursts echoed, and then silence. So much for our distraction, Kurt said. Let's get out of here. We have to shimmy this thing forward, Joe said, like a snowboarder starting his run. Kurt hung the identifier on Joe. You're the pilot. If the robots see us, it's best you don't get shot. With the chute billowing in the breeze, they shifted their weight forward and the wings slid off the edge. They accelerated down and away from the building, dropping and picking up speed like an eagle diving from a cliffside nest. The wing and parasail generated instant lift while the weight of the three men provided momentum, which translated into forward speed. They soared down the front side of the island across the open area where the helicopter had touched down. Flying low and fast, they raced across the boundary of the seawall and out over the waves. If a single gunshot came their way, none of them heard it. Flying clear, they turned their speed back into altitude, but like any glider not caught in an updraft, that was eventually a losing proposition. Gaining altitude cost them speed, and the next drop took them lower. "We're sinking fast," Kurt noted. "Not much we can do about that," Joe said. "Let's hope Akiko sees us." Riding with the wind, they were carried across the channel at a rapid clip. But soon they were skimming the waves and pulling back on the chute to gain a few seconds of extra airtime. "Prepare to ditch," Joe said. The wing skimmed one swell and then clipped the next, stopping instantaneously. Kurt, Joe, and Nagano were thrown forward into the swells. Kurt went under, tasted the salt water on his lips, and came up in time to see the chute settling into the waves. Joe popped up from under the chute, clearing the lines and swimming away. Nagano was treading water next to him. Since the hollow wing floated, the three of them grasped its edges. "See anything?" Kurt asked. "No, but I hear something," Joe said. A second later, Kurt heard it too, a motorboat racing their way. It came out of the darkness, detectable only by the white bow wave, until the lights came on at the last second. Akiko leaned over as she pulled alongside. "About time you came back," she said. "A girl could drown out here, waiting in the rain." Kurt helped Nagano into the boat. Joe climbed in behind them. Before they could move, fiberglass began exploding around them as rifle shots from the island came their way. Dropping flat onto the floor of the boat, Kurt shouted to Akiko, "Kill the lights! Get us out of here!" She reached up, gunned the throttle, and turned the wheel. The boat spun and leapt forward, but the onslaught continued. Kurt felt a bullet scrape his arm. He watched the windshield shatter and the marine radio explode as a shell hit it dead center. The transom and the back end of the boat took a dozen hits or more before they finally drove out of range. Akiko kept the throttle open. "Everyone okay?" Kurt asked. Nagano nodded. Joe was bleeding from a flesh wound on his thigh, but was otherwise unhurt. Akiko picked fiberglass shards out of her hair. The boat continued on, putting distance between them, the warbots, and the gunmen on the island, but smoke was pouring from the motor housing. They made it a mile or so before flames erupted from beneath the cowling.
"Shut it down," Joe called out, grabbing a fire extinguisher.
Akiko pulled the throttle back to zero and the boat began coasting. It continued to slow until its momentum was used up. Joe lifted the engine cowling and doused the flames with a fire extinguisher. One look told him they were stuck.
"That's not fixable."
"Now what?" Akiko said. Kurt turned toward the mainland. The sky was beginning to lighten over Nagasaki. Dawn was almost upon them.
"You two stay here," he said to Akiko and Nagano. "Wave down any passing ship you see. Joe and I are going to swim for it."
"It's a full mile to shore," Akiko said.
"At least," Kurt said. "Let's hope the tide is with us."
Chapter 56 Shanghai.
It was still dark as Paul and Gemme walked across the vacant plaza of the People's Square in central Shanghai.
"This was once a racetrack for horses," Mel told them. "But the Communist Party didn't like gambling, so they put an end to that and made it a park."
"How appropriate," Paul said, "considering we're about to bet our freedom on a long shot." They continued across the park and approached a government building. It was unofficially known as the Oyster, because the lower levels were hidden from view by a graceful curve of concrete and glass, which one had to pass under before approaching the front doors. There was no hesitation. All the important decisions had been made. All that remained was to see how things played out. They arrived at the door, waiting patiently as Mel used her credentials to placate the guard outside the building.
"Why don't I go in alone?" Paul said. "If it goes badly, you two still have a chance to escape."
Gemme shook her head. "For better or for worse, remember?"
"This is definitely worse."
"It'll be fine," she said. "Besides, prison can't be any worse than sleeping in a van."
"If only that were true," Paul said. "Still, we're overdue for an upswing in fortune, that's for sure."
They stepped inside and came to a checkpoint that was manned 24 hours a day. Several guards came up and began rummaging through their equipment.
"Credentials," one guard said. Mel produced her network ID and began to explain, "These two were part of my new production crew. They're..."
The lead guard ignored her, staring intently at Paul and Gemme. After a second of indecision, he shouted something in Chinese and waved his crew forward. The Americans were soon surrounded.
"We're here to see General Zhang," Paul said. "We're here to surrender. We have something he needs to see."
Melanie repeated the phrase in Chinese. The leader shook his head and picked up a phone. The other guards drew their guns. One of them tried to force Paul to his knees.
"Allow them to enter."
The voice came from the shadows. All eyes turned in that direction, and the frenetic activity ceased. From the depths of the lobby, a short, stocky figure emerged. He wore a full military uniform in the pea-green color of the People's Liberation Army. His chest was bedecked with medals, and his hat, his cover, was pulled down tightly, shading his eyes. The security crew snapped to attention.
"Search them thoroughly, and see them to my office," the new arrival said.
"General," the lead guard said, "these two are wanted criminals. They are listed on the sheet as Priority One apprehensions, enemies of the state." The general stared laser beams at the security agent.
"I gave you an order."
"Yes, General." Paul and Gemme watched the events unfold with a running translation from Mel. It was easy enough to see they'd found General Zhang.
"I guess Rudy has a friend here after all."
Searched thoroughly and relieved of all their equipment, they were taken into the building and separated from Mel. Paul and Gemme were led up to a seventh-floor office. They were left inside on their own.
"Now what?" Paul said.
"We wait," Gemme said. "Let's hope General Zhang is willing to listen."
Paul certainly hoped so. He turned and gazed out a large picture window, with its view over the building's shell and out onto the plaza. The gray morning had arrived.
"Those windows don't open," General Zhang said. "So if you're thinking of escaping..." He came through the door with the laptop under his arm. Paul turned his way. Gamet stood respectfully.
We wouldn't have surrendered if that was the plan, Paul said. Are you General Zhang?
I am, the general replied. And the two of you are Paul and Gamet Trout, members of NUMA and American citizens. Some would say you're also spies. Certainly you're both here illegally. And I must inform you, that is a crime punishable by death.
Paul doubted there would be any firing squad, but years in a Chinese gulag were not out of the question.
We're hoping all of that can be avoided, Paul said. We are not here as spies, but as messengers. That's why Rudy contacted you. He's trusting you to hear what we have to say.
Trusting me, the general said. He laughed lightly, removed his cap, and placed it on the desk. Only if he's a fool.
But you do know him, Gamet said, standing up. Don't you?
Rudy Gunn sent me a message. He asked me to hear you out. He implored me to listen based on our previous contacts during the Nighthawk catastrophe. You two were part of that also, if I'm not mistaken.
Paul and Gamet both nodded. The general sat on the edge of his desk.
I spoke to many people in your government that night. Most of them were arrogant, combative, and pig-headed. But Rudy gained my respect. He spoke facts instead of positions. He sought results instead of posturing for leverage. For that reason, I've agreed to hear you out. But I warn you, that's all I've agreed to.
Understanding the connection between Rudy and Zhang gave Paul more confidence.
Rudy told you how to defuse the bomb that had been placed aboard the Chinese aircraft. Gamet and I risked our lives to get that information to Rudy in the first place.
Admirable, Zhang said, but irrelevant to me. You were trying to save your own cities at the time.
There's truth to that as well, Gamet said.
Zhang waved toward the seats near his desk. Down to business, he said. Tell me, what could possibly be worth violating my country's sovereignty and risking your lives over?
Better if we show you, Paul said. He reached for the laptop. May I?
Zhang handed it over, and Paul began the presentation. He went through the data methodically, explaining step by step how they'd discovered and measured the accelerating rise in the sea levels, how they'd traced it to the East China Sea, and then to the deep water mining operation. Finally, he explained the science that led them to the fissures cutting through the continental plate and the unfathomable amounts of water held in the layer of ringwoodite down below.
General Zhang watched the presentation calmly, interrupting with an occasional question, but otherwise waiting patiently for Paul to finish.
You make it sound so plausible, he then said. But why would the water still be rising to the surface if the mining operation has been abandoned for a year?
We don't know, Paul admitted. But have your geologists look at the data. Have them run any test or experiment they want. They'll come to the same conclusion.
And I'm supposed to believe this isn't a desperate ploy to make us reveal the nature of the subsurface operation?
He spoke with great sarcasm in his voice. But Paul sensed it was a perfunctory question. While he considered how to respond, Gamet took it upon herself to reply.
General, she said politely, do you really think we'd throw our freedom away on a lie? If we're wrong, you'll put us in prison for years until a trade is worked out. We're not spies and we're not pawns. We came here of our own free will, looking for answers. It was only when we were cornered and threatened that we went on the run. You asked what would compel us to risk our lives and violate China's border. The answer is simple. To avert disaster. The same reason Rudy contacted you a year ago when your agents stole the containment unit from the Nighthawk.
Zhang remained quiet. He seemed to be considering everything that was said. Paul added a few thoughts.
As a high-ranking member of the Chinese Security Service, you might already know everything we've told you, in which case, the only decision you have to make is what to do with us. But if this is news, then you're either wondering how it all transpired under your nose,
or if perhaps we're making it up. Assuming that's the case, might I suggest you check on our story? There are plenty of ways to verify what we've told you, the simplest of which is to send an ROV to the canyon and get the truth for yourself. You might also pull a file on Walter Hahn and see what he's been up to. The general narrowed his gaze.
Walter Hahn? The industrialist?
Yes, Paul said. We have reason to believe the half-buried robot on the video is one of his. And we know for a fact that he's been running around Japan attempting to prevent us and our colleagues from investigating since we arrived there.
The general looked down and tugged at the crease in his slacks. This news seemed to bother him more than anything else he'd been told. He turned to the windows that didn't open and stared out through them, much as Paul had earlier.
"I'm afraid you've come to the wrong man," he said finally. "If Walter Hahn is involved, then these events are being directed from a position far above mine."
"And whose position might that be?"
Gemme asked.
General Zhang didn't answer. Paul stepped forward. A reluctant ally was better than a smiling enemy, and he sensed that's what they'd found.
"It's your job to protect China, is it not?"
"Of course," Zhang said.
"Then consider this," Paul said. "What we've shown you will become obvious to the rest of the world before too long. The sea level is rising, and the pace of that rise is accelerating. The cause is almost certainly the mining operation at the bottom of the East China Sea. That truth is going to come out whether you want it to or not. At this moment, and not for very much longer, you and you alone have the ability to control how that truth is revealed."
Zhang was listening. "Go on."
"There are two possibilities," Paul said. "This event can be a massive ecological disaster caused by the Chinese government, or it can be the result of a rogue industrialist putting the world in danger through his own arrogance and lust for wealth."
"Blame it on Hahn," the general said. "Find a scapegoat. That's what you're suggesting."
"Save face for China," Paul corrected. "If you play the hero by exposing the corruption and singling out Walter Hahn, you can protect China's reputation. Even if he's backed by your government in some form or another, those links can be erased. Considering the situation, our government will agree to keep it a secret. But you have to act soon. You have to get out in front of this."
"And Hahn is thrown to the wolves," Zhang said.
"Someone has to be. Why not him?"
Zhang folded both arms across his chest, contemplating silently. He did not move for a full minute, and then walked back to the desk.
"You two will remain here," he said. "I've sent the guards who saw you enter on an early vacation. Don't worry. No harm will come to them. Nor to your friend, the reporter. No one else knows of your presence in this building. But, ironically enough, the very people who are hunting you reside several floors above us."
Without another word, Zhang plucked his hat from the desktop, put it firmly in place, and walked out the door. General Zhang got off the elevator on the ninth floor of the building. He strode down the hall, arriving outside an office at the far end. A second layer of security stood at attention as he approached.
"Is the Lao Shu present?" he asked a two-stripe corporal.
"Yes, sir," the corporal said. "He is not to be disturbed."
"I will see him," Zhang said.
"But, sir, I will see him. Now."
The corporal fell silent. Nothing could be worse for a low-ranking enlisted man than to face conflicting orders from higher-ups. In the end, Zhang was a general, and Wen was a politician. The uniform made the difference. He snapped a salute, opened the door, and stood aside. Zhang wandered in and discovered Wen sitting on a couch, watching the morning news. From Japan. Wen did not look up.
"I left orders not to be disturbed."
"So you did," Zhang said. "I countermanded them."
Wen was not a reactionary man. Few who held such power were, as they didn't need to be.
but his frame tensed at the insubordination.
"Leave me, General," he said dismissively. "I did not call for you, and unless your forces have finally proven competent and captured the Americans, I have no desire to speak with you."
Wen had forced every military and police organization in the government to share in the search for the Americans. Such was his power. It was Zhang's reason for being in Shanghai when he would have preferred to remain in Beijing, but Wen had refused him that luxury. He stepped forward. The cap was removed once again. "The Americans have indeed been found," he said, "and they tell a most interesting story." Only now did Wen give Zhang his full attention.
"Where are they? I will see them at once."
"That will have to wait." Wen stood up, and the benign old face looked suddenly menacing and evil.
"You dare defy me? I thought you were smarter than that."
Zhang wondered if he was making a mistake. Wen was the second most powerful man in the country, and the main architect of so much mischief. While the Chinese premier ran the country and dealt with the day-to-day operations of the Communist Party, Wen remained behind the scenes, manipulating levers most did not even know about. He could make or break anyone, even a man as important as General Zhang. Then again, China was no place for the timid. It was more like ancient Rome than Western governments. Power was collected and wielded. It was taken, not given. And Zhang now had a chip to play. "What is Walter Han doing for you in Japan? We know he's a proxy of yours."
"That question will cost you dearly, General."
"Nevertheless, I will have an answer."
The standoff continued. Wen stared, unused to being challenged in any real fashion. Zhang stood rigid, holding his ground.
Finally, Wen turned away. He walked to a small table and sat down. Another half-finished game of Go was arranged on the table. Wen reached into the pot and pulled out a black stone.
"Hands where I can see them, Lao She." "Are you arresting me?" Wen asked.
"That depends on what Walter Han is up to in Japan," Zhang said, "and on his connection with the mining disaster at the Serpent's Jaw."
"Ah," Wen said, "so you know a thing or two."
He turned his full attention to the game board and refused to honor Zhang with another glance. He pointed a bony finger toward the television screen.
"Watch the news," he said. "Soon, you will see."
Chapter 57. Nagasaki Prefecture. Kurt and Joe emerged from the water on a stony beach. Tossing their fins aside, they raced across the beach like competitors in a triathlon. The similarity ended when they smashed the window of a car, silenced the alarm, and hotwired it in record time. Speeding down the coastal road, Kurt stated the obvious. "We need to get to the Friendship Pavilion before the signing ceremony."
"We could go to the police," Joe suggested.
"And tell them what?" Kurt asked. "Robots that look exactly like us are going to shoot the Prime Minister? The truth will get us sedated and put in a hospital for the delusional."
"At least it would give us an alibi," Joe suggested.
"We can hardly have assassinated the Prime Minister if we were being medicated in a psych ward at the time."
"That won't save the Prime Minister or implicate Han," Kurt said. "And I intend to do both."
"How?"
"Catching him in the act. Ripping the masks off those robots in front of the TV cameras."
"Great idea," Joe said. "But if we're 1 minute late..."
"I know," Kurt said, changing gears and charging through the traffic. "We'll have played right into his hands one more time."
A mile down the road, Kurt pulled over in front of a store that had yet to open for the day. He and Joe broke in and rummaged through the clothes on the rack. Grabbing some items, they raced out and drove off.
"We're a regular two-man crime wave," Joe said. "We've stolen a boat, a car, and clothes, all in the last 24 hours. If this keeps up, Nagano will be right to claim it's the foreigners doing all the law-breaking in Japan."
"Let's hope he gets the chance." Kurt drove on until the traffic became impassable. The area near the pavilion was packed with visitors, members of the media and security teams. Every road Kurt turned down was either mired in gridlock or cordoned off.
"Ditch the car," Joe suggested. "We'll go on foot."
Kurt parked and the two of them got out and ran. Soon they were queuing up with the crowd and then passing through a metal detector before entering the pavilion.
"Wonder how the robots managed that," Joe whispered.
"Probably came in the back door," Kurt said, betting Nagano's ID came in handy for that.
"Where do you think we'll find them?"
"Not sure about the others," Kurt said, "but my duplicate will be front and center at the signing, so the whole world will have a perfect view of the action. The others will probably be arranged along an escape route. The real question is, how do we stop them? They're a lot stronger than us, and basically bulletproof." Joe gave him a brief smile.
"I've been wrestling with that question ever since I saw you wrestling with yourself and losing."
"And?"
"Remember the pat-down at Kenzo's castle?" Joe said. "They used a big electromagnet to wipe out the programming from any devices we might have concealed. We can do the same to our robotic twins."
Kurt grinned, as he always did at Joe's brilliance. "Can you rig one up?"
"All I need is a large metal nail, an extension cord, and an outlet to plug it into."
The ceremony was a formal one, but like so many things in politics, it was primarily driven by the needs of the press. TV cameras were arranged. Photographers with their tripods and bags of equipment were given floor space up front. Reporters with recording devices stood shoulder to shoulder behind them. Han watched the throng assemble. It would all be over in a few minutes. He would be on his way back to China and glory. He found his heart racing in anticipation. Finally, the Japanese Prime Minister and the Chinese ambassador arrived. Their handshake lasted a full 30 seconds, so everyone could capture the image in just the right way. Flashes went off in a dizzying, almost hypnotic display. The ambassador stepped to the podium and offered a short statement. He gave way to the Prime Minister, who spoke at some length. Han stood proudly behind them, along with a few others who'd helped make this moment a reality. While everyone else watched the politicians, Han squinted against the glare of the lights, looking for the facsimile of Austin. The three robots were on autonomous mode now, with Austin's machine programmed to make its angry declaration and shoot as the last copy of the agreement was being signed. The Nagano facsimile would be waiting down a back hallway, guarding the way out, while the Zavala facsimile had made only a brief appearance, to assure it was seen by the cameras, and then returned to the getaway vehicle, which, in a delicious twist, was Nagano's unmarked police car, taken by Ushioni when he abducted Nagano from the Shinto temple in the mountains. Everything was in place. The plan was perfect.
Chapter 58 Friendship Pavilion.
The Nagano facsimile stood in a vacant hall near the back of the building. It had no true thoughts as such. Its processors had simply determined that this door was the most likely to be blocked by security once the event occurred. It would remain here until the next phase of the operation began, ensuring access to the outside parking lot. When the Austin facsimile unit appeared, both units would leave the building together, pacing to be determined by threat activity. Until then, it would continue to run its human mimicry program and ensure that the door remained unlocked. Its optical processors detected the approach of two maintenance workers, identifying them by uniform. A secondary routine built into its programming determined they were not a threat, while a third routine caused it to smile and offer a slight bow. At the same time, a different algorithm designed to scan faces and make a recognition if possible, failed to operate. This occurred not because the function was offline, but because the men approaching had their caps pulled down far enough to block most of their features. Still, absent a threat determination, the machine remained in a passive state, and the human mimicry program continued as the priority function. A subroutine of that program limited the amount of time the unit could stand still and stare. Two obvious giveaways in robotic performance. After 3 seconds of watching the subject's approach, the Nagano facsimile looked away, raised its left arm in a crook, and used its right hand to pull the cuff of its sleeve back. At the same time, it directed its optical sensors toward the watch on its left wrist. It did not record the time. Time was kept perfectly within its CPU, nor did it have any understanding of what it was doing. The act was merely part of its program. Behavior mimicked successfully. Its next directive was to fold its arms, exhale, and look out the small window in the door. Damage detected. Its internal sensors reacted to sharp impact in its lower back. The outer padding had been punctured. Self-protection routine kicked in and the machine spun, reaching for its weapon. But before it completed its turn, all processing ceased. Kurt removed the sharpened metal rod from the replica's back and held it cautiously in rubber-gloved hands. A bare copper wire was visible wrapped around the length of the rod in tight coils. It led back to the rubber sheathing of a 100-foot extension cord. That cord led to Joe, who crouched beside the wall socket he'd plugged it into. Kurt had plunged the metal spike through the artificial flesh and padding of the replica. The 100-volt current of the Japanese electrical system did the rest, creating a cycling electromagnetic field and a power surge in the robot at the same time. In the blink of an eye, it disrupted the robot's CPU and erased its programming. The Nagano facsimile didn't cry out in pain or react in any outward way. No sparks flew, no mechanical seizures. It just turned slightly to the right and shut down. Now it stood as still as any mannequin. Kurt waved a hand in front of its eyes. Nothing. Joe came running up, gathering the extension cord in loops as he approached. What did I tell you? You're a genius, Kurt said. Are you sure this thing isn't going to wake back up? Not after that shock, Joe said. Even if it did come back online, it won't have any programming files. It won't know what to do. It'll just stand there. One down, two to go, Kurt said. Let's lock this thing in that broom closet where we found these uniforms and get moving. Han waited as the Prime Minister finished his lengthy speech. Finally, he thought. The ceremonial pens were handed out. 6 copies of the agreement placed on the desk. The first copy was signed, and the pens placed aside. New pens appeared for the second copy, and so on. As the 5th copy was being autographed, the ambassador accidentally dropped his pen. It fell off the table and rolled onto the floor. Both men picked it up together. Cooperation, the Prime Minister said. Everyone laughed. The final copy was placed on the table. Han could barely handle the adrenaline. He looked out into the crowd once more to reassure himself. The Austin facsimile was creeping closer, pushing confidently through the crowd toward the front of the photographer's row. It looked ready to draw its weapon and open fire. But something was wrong. No, Han whispered. No. Pen was put to paper. The facsimile burst forward, throwing a photographer aside. Japan will never be an ally of China. The machine raised a pistol and was tackled as it opened fire, not by members of the security detail, but by the real Kurt Austin. 4 shots rang out. The bullets flew low, drilling the platform and little else. The crowd shrieked in unison and began to scatter. Han could hardly believe his eyes. He stood motionless for a second, stunned, and then he fled. Kurt tackled the machine and plunged the metal rod into its back. But aside from a moment of stiffness, the machine hadn't been affected. It functioned without restraint and threw Kurt off with a violent jerk of its arm. Kurt flew several feet and knocked over a group of vacant chairs as the machine stood and opened fire again. The shots hit members of the Prime Minister's security detail, who'd formed up around him and were trying to get him out of the room. Three men went down in rapid succession. A fourth fired back before he too was gunned down by the robot. Kurt looked at the rod in his hands as if it had betrayed him. But the truth was simpler than that. Someone in the fleeing crowd had tripped over the cord and pulled it from the socket. Kurt grabbed a chair and smashed it over the back of the machine. The robot was knocked off balance, but it didn't fall. It turned and belted Kurt, knocking him over a camera dolly. With Kurt knocked aside, the facsimile took one more shot. This time, the Prime Minister was protected by a civilian, who tackled him from the side, taking a bullet in the process. Kurt knew he couldn't overpower the robot. He grabbed the power cord, whipped it toward him, and plugged it into an outlet beside the TV camera. As the replica moved forward, looking for a kill shot, Kurt rushed the stage and plunged the metal spike into the spine of his mechanical twin. The facsimile froze in an awkward position and toppled forward. Kurt held the machine down, pulled the spike out, and plunged it in once more just to be sure. By now, police and paramilitary units were rushing into the room. They surrounded Kurt and pulled him off the robot. Turning the machine over, they froze at the odd discovery, their collective gaze going from the attacker to the Good Samaritan who'd stopped it, and back again. Kurt didn't have time to explain. He used the sharpened spike to cut into the skin on the replica's neck. Peeling it back, he revealed the automated mask of the machine's face. The hydraulics twitched as spare signals came and went. The glass eyes stared blankly into the distance. It was the last Kurt saw of the machine. With an abundance of caution, the police dragged him away. "Leave him," a voice ordered. Kurt looked up. To his surprise, he saw Nagano limping into the room. The superintendent looked like death warmed over, but he wore an official police jacket. "If you didn't look so beaten up, I might think you were a machine," Kurt said. "I'd be in a lot less pain if I was," Nagano said. Kurt laughed. "When did you get here?" "A moment too late, it seems." Nagano helped Kurt up and they climbed onto the stage. The Prime Minister was being ushered out of the room, while paramedics tended to his security team and the civilian who'd intervened on his behalf. "Akiko," Kurt said, crouching beside her. She'd taken a bullet in the back, diving in front of the Prime Minister. "I told you I'm good in a fight," she whispered. "She has a punctured lung," the paramedic explained. "She should be okay, but we need to get her to the hospital." "Go," Nagano said. Kurt squeezed Akiko's hand as she was lifted onto a stretcher and whisked away. "I'm guessing you didn't swim," Kurt said. "We flagged down a fishing boat shortly after dawn," Nagano explained. "We got here as soon as we could. But as you can imagine, without ID and looking like we did, it was hard to explain who we really were. By the time I found someone to listen, the shooting had already begun. So we ran up here. Akiko ran faster than any of us." "She's a hero," Kurt said. "She pledged to defend Kenzo, promised to do the same for me, and wound up saving the Prime Minister." "Sounds like a promotion." "My thoughts exactly," Kurt said. Nagano smiled. "I'm afraid we still have Han to deal with. He seems to have gotten away. If he gets back to China, we'll never extradite him." "Don't worry," Kurt said. "He won't make it that far." Chapter 59. Han ran when the shooting started, just like everyone else, but he ran for other reasons, and he ran in a different direction. He charged through the back of the pavilion and raced down the access stairs. Several policemen passed him, rushing in the opposite direction and not giving him a second glance. He reached the bottom floor and the door that Nagano's facsimile was supposed to be guarding. The machine was nowhere in sight, and Han didn't bother looking for it. He pushed the door open and raced outside. His limousine was parked in the VIP lot around the side. He marched toward it, and then stopped cold. The police had the limo surrounded. As Han watched, they pulled the door open, dragged his chauffeur out, and forced him to lie on the ground.